This is the daily radio ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the Gospel of Luke. Now, here's Pastor Sandy in the Gospel of Luke, chapter 6.
Well, in 1891, James Naismith invented the game of basketball. Naismith was a professor at Kansas University, and he was looking for some kind of an activity to preoccupy his athletes through the winter months between football season and baseball season. Naismith came up with the game of basketball. When he invented basketball, he compiled a list of just 13 rules. That's all there was. 13 rules. Today, the official basketball rule book contains 50 articles, each with multiple subpoints. The International Basketball Rulebook is 81 pages long. That's a long way from James Naismith's 13 rules. The expansion of the rules of basketball is a testimony to the human tendency to complicate whatever we touch. We gravitate toward from simple toward complex. We love to add rules and restrictions and explanations, and this is especially true when it comes to religion. Take, for example, the fourth commandment. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. You see, the law of Moses gave broad, general instructions to observe one day in seven as a day of rest and worship. Work was forbidden on the Sabbath day. But the Jews felt compelled to define what constituted work. You couldn't wear your dentures on the Sabbath day. You couldn't strap on your artificial leg. You couldn't lift a child on the Sabbath day, or you would be carrying a load, and that would constitute work. A man could spit on the ground on the Sabbath day, just as long as he didn't scuff it with his shoe. If he did, he would be watering and cultivating the soil and therefore working. You know, in reality, one man's work is another man's relaxation. Some folks see gardening and yard work as therapeutic. It's a healthy diversion. It's a way for them to unwind. I think I would rather join the chain gang than pull weeds and work in flower beds. I'll put it that way. And this is why God gave us this general command concerning the Sabbath. Keep the Sabbath day holy. But then he left the details of its observance up to each person's own conscience. Tragically, though, the Jews couldn't leave it at that. They went to great effort to define what constituted work. Page after page after page in the Jewish Mishnah and the Talmud are devoted to the subject of Sabbath observance. You know, it's been said of the American legal system, we have 35 million laws trying to enforce 10 commandments. Well, that's also a good description of Judaism. And yet Jesus came to simplify. The Jews had smothered the intent of God's law under a thick blanket of their own interpretations. Jesus wanted to restore the spirit of the law, and that's what he attempts to do here in Luke chapter 6. Now it happened on the second Sabbath after the first that he went through the grain fields, and his disciples plucked the heads of grain and ate them, rubbing them in their hands. And some of the Pharisees said to them, "Why are you doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath?" Now, according to the legalistic Jews, the Pharisees, there were four things that you couldn't do with the grain on the Sabbath day. You couldn't reap, you couldn't thresh, you couldn't winnow, and you couldn't cook. There could be no plucking, no shucking, no separating, and no eating on the Sabbath day, or no cooking on the Sabbath day. Thus, when the disciples, when they rubbed the grain between their hands, and then they blew off the chaff, and then they ate the dry cereal, they were guilty of all four forbidden stipulations. Can you believe eating your Wheaties would be considered a sin? You know, it's interesting, the traditions of the Pharisees also prohibited a Jew from traveling more than 3,000 feet from his home on the Sabbath day. Makes you wonder what these cats are doing out in the field somewhere scrutinizing the breakfast habits of Jesus and his disciples. It was so hypocritical. To catch Jesus breaking the rules, they had violated their own rules themselves. Well, verse 3 tells us, but Jesus answering them said, have you not even read this, what David did when he was hungry, he and those who were with him, how he went into the house of God, took and ate the showbread, and also gave some to those with him, which is not lawful for any but the priest to eat? Of course, David was the Jewish champion. All Jews respected David's heart for God. And yet when David had fled from Saul, he stopped by the sanctuary on his way out of Dodge. He and his men were tired and they were famished and they were starving. The priest wanted to strengthen David's troops, but the only food on hand was the sacred showbread. And according to God's law, only the priest could eat this bread. And yet, David didn't hesitate. Like Jesus' disciples on the Sabbath, David ate his Wheaties. He ate the showbread. It was the breakfast of champions, no doubt about it. David and Jesus both broke a ceremonial law in order to keep a higher moral law. Let me give you an example. Normally, driving 80 miles per hour is a violation of the law, wouldn't you say? Unless you're rushing a person in critical condition to the hospital. All of a sudden, a higher law has now superseded a lower law. Well, Jesus was trying to showcase a basic principle to the Jews that they'd failed to recognize. Human need always trumps. It always takes precedence over religious ritual. In God's eyes, compassion on people is more important than tradition. At times, the letter of the law needs to be violated in order to keep the spirit of the law. That's what Jesus and his disciples were doing in the grain field on the Sabbath day. And then Jesus, he adds a kicker. He says, the Son of Man is also Lord of the Sabbath. This really ruffled some feathers. Jesus is saying that he is the lawgiver. He's the Lord of the Sabbath. He was the voice from Sinai who gave the law to Moses. Jesus was the Lord of the law. And if he gave it, then he can change it or he can supersede it at his prerogative. In other words, Jesus wasn't bound by his own law. And this infuriated the Pharisees. Verse 6, now it happened on another Sabbath also that he entered the synagogue and taught. And a man was there whose right hand was withered. So the scribes and Pharisees watched him closely, whether he would heal on the Sabbath, that they might find an accusation against him. Another Jewish prohibition on the Sabbath day, believe it or not, was healing. You couldn't heal on the Sabbath day. That was work. Now, you could stop someone from dying. But if you improved their condition, it was considered work. It was not allowed. By this time, everyone knew that Jesus loved people. And if there was a needy person in the house, Jesus would probably just heal him. The Pharisees probably planted this fellow with the arthritic hand in the room in order to trap Jesus. Well, verse 8 tells us, but he knew their thoughts, and he said to the man who had the withered hand, arise and stand here, and he arose and stood. Jesus is making him an example. He's about to teach them a lesson. And then Jesus said to them, I will ask you one thing. Is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do evil, to save life or to destroy it? Jesus is the one who springs the trap. He's saying, how can a good deed ever be unlawful or evil? I mean, what's more important here, maintaining a tradition or saving a man's life? And when he had looked around at them all, and I love what Mark adds, Mark 3 verse 5 adds, he looked around with anger, being grieved by the hardness of their hearts. And he said to the man, stretch out your hand. And he did so, and his hand was restored as whole as the other. Now, I haven't had a withered hand, but over the last 3 months, I have had a withered thumb. I cut my tendon on my thumb back in May, and I still can't bend it. And it's odd. I'm used to telling my thumb to bend and then watching it actually bend, but I no longer have that capacity. This man's whole hand was arthritic. It was curled up in a ball. He couldn't stretch out his fingers even if he wanted. And now Jesus gives him an impossible command. He says to him, stretch out your hand. Hey, did you realize that all faith is the willingness to act on an impossible command? That's what faith is. You were born in sin. You've been a sinner your whole life. There is nothing you can do about your sin. And yet Romans 6 verse 11 commands you, reckon yourselves to be dead indeed to sin, but alive to God. The word reckon means to consider it so. Thus, the moment you believe and act as if God's word is true in you, then it suddenly becomes true. This is what happened to the man with the withered hand. The moment he believed he could stretch out his hand, God made him abundantly able. And here's how faith works. God calls you to be this, or he calls you to do that. And yet you say, oh, I can't do that. It's not in me to be that. And it's not. But if you act as if it is, if you believe, suddenly God will make you able. If you provide the willingness, God will give you the ability. He'll work a miracle. Jesus told this man, stretch out your hand. And amazingly, he did. And the Jews rejoiced and they praised God. Whoops, that's not what it says. They were filled with rage and discussed with one another what they might do to Jesus. What a terrible reaction to a glorious miracle. Now here's what angered the Pharisees. They could tell everyone else what to do on the Sabbath day except God. God wouldn't keep their commands, and that ticked them off. You know, we say the Pharisees rejected Jesus because he claimed to be God, and that's true. But the opposite is also true. They weren't ready for God, and so they rejected Jesus. You see, they worshiped a God in a box. A God that they could control. A God who would bow to their own terms and play by their own rules. The true God is wild and woolly. He blows up our traditions. He does what he pleases and expects us to bow to him, not vice versa. And so the question for us is, are we ready to follow the real God? Well, verse 12 tells us, now it came to pass in those days that he went out to the mountain to pray and continued all night in prayer to God. Now at the time, Jesus is on the western shore of the Sea of Galilee. He's near the town of Capernaum. And just south of Capernaum, there is a mountain that towers above the lake. Its steep face rises out of the water. It's known as Mount Arbel. And to me, a trip to Israel is not complete without climbing to the top of the Arbel. The view there is so panoramic. It's such a special spot. It's remote, it's quiet, it's majestic. It would be the perfect spot for prayer and meditation. It may have been here on this mountain that Jesus spent this night in prayer. We're told when it was day, he called his disciples to himself. And from them, he chose 12, whom he also named apostles. The word disciple means learner or follower. The word apostle means one who is sent out, an ambassador. The two words combined include a progression or indicate a progression. You see, Christians begin as learners, but we're not intended to stay learners forever. Jesus has marching orders for all of us. the time comes for each of us to act on what we've learned. I know Christians who've been learning forever, but they've never acted on anything they've learned. Disciples eventually become apostles. Jesus chose 12. Now, the 12 apostles, they were the men who would start the church and literally spread the Christian gospel around the world. Choosing them wisely was extremely important. And this is why it's no surprise that Jesus spent the night beforehand in prayer. And if it was important for Jesus to pray before making his decisions, how much more important is it for us to also follow in his footsteps? You know, taking a few minutes to pray can save you a lot of hours trying to straighten out a bad decision. Jesus prayed before he made his choices. And in the next three verses, Luke names the 12 men that he chose. Simon, whom he also named Peter, and Andrew, his brother. Then James and John, also brothers, by the way. So he chose two sets of brothers, Philip and Bartholomew, Matthew and Thomas, James the son of Alphaeus, and Simon called the Zealot. Now the Zealots, they were a radical paramilitary unit. They were bent on using violence to drive the Romans out of Judea. They were Jewish freedom fighters, you might call them. Whereas the tax collectors were just the opposite. They were Roman collaborators. The Jews saw the tax collectors as sellouts. Now imagine Matthew and Simon on the same team. We're talking about mortal enemies. That's not to mention an impulsive Peter and a cautious Thomas. I mean, what a diverse band of personalities and priorities here. Obviously, Jesus wanted to show the world that allegiance to him could transcend major differences. That's why he chose such a diverse group of disciples. And then he finishes the list in verse 16, Judas, the son of James, and Judas Iscariot, who also became a traitor. Now, here's a very provocative point. If Jesus prayed the night before, then Judas Iscariot was an answer to his prayer. Isn't that interesting? I would have asked the Lord, please, Lord, weed out any troublemakers. Keep me from choosing any betrayers, any Judases tomorrow. But God's ways are not our ways, are they? You know, sometimes he has a purpose for putting difficult people in our lives. He does. He can use them to help us. He can use us to help them. And he came down with them, and he stood on a level place. Now, the Arbel's eastern slope is a sheer drop-off right into the water. But west of the summit stretches out over level ground. It forms a plain. Perhaps it was here that Jesus then met with a crowd of his disciples. And a great multitude, Luke tells us, of people from all Judea and Jerusalem and from the seacoast of Tyre and Sidon who came to hear him and be healed of their diseases, as well as those who were tormented with unclean spirits. And they were healed, and the whole multitude sought to touch him, for power went out from him and healed them all. And notice that all were healed. Nobody was left out. No one went home that day untouched by God's love and power. Jesus saw to it. Verse 20, then he lifted up his eyes toward his disciples and said, "Blessed are you poor, for yours is the kingdom of God." Now the rest of Luke chapter 6 is very similar to Matthew chapters 5 through 7, which we call the Sermon on the Mount. And there are scholars who are quick to pick up here on some discrepancies. They assume that Luke 6 and Matthew 5 through 7 are the same sermon. I don't think so. The sermon in Matthew was delivered on a mountainside. Here, the people assemble on a plain, in a flat, level area. I don't think there are any discrepancies at all here, because I think what you have is a different sermon. delivered at a different time, in a different place, to different people. There's some repeated content. Matter of fact, you listen to my sermons long enough, you'll hear some repeated content, especially the jokes. There's some repeated content. There's some similar structure, but I believe that there were two different sermons. Matthew 5 through 7, the Sermon on the Mount. Luke chapter 6, the Sermon on the Plain. Jesus begins his sermon, verse 20, "Blessed are you who hunger now, for you shall be filled. Blessed are you who weep now, for you shall laugh." One of the misconceptions that humans make is to assume that wealth and health and happiness are indicators of God's blessing, whereas poverty and sickness and sorrow are signs of God's curse. You remember, this was the source of Job's confusion. Job was innocent of any wrongdoing, and yet tragically, calamity still struck. Job's troubles threw a wrench in the prevailing theology of his day. Likewise, Jesus rebuffed this kind of kindergarten theology. Jesus taught that a person's physical situation had nothing to do with his spiritual status. A rich man is not necessarily blessed, and a poor man is not necessarily cursed. In fact, Jesus says, "Blessed or happy are those who hunger now and who weep now." Why? Since God sees to it that they eventually laugh and they'll eventually be full. You see, according to Jesus, the kingdom of God is not about the here and now necessarily. The tables will be turned when we get to eternity. The haves on earth will be eternity's have-nots, and today's have-nots will be heaven's haves. He goes on, he says, "Blessed are you when men hate you, and when they exclude you and revile you and cast out your name as evil for the Son of Man's sake." Jesus promised us in John 16, verse 33, "In this world you will have tribulation." You can count on it. God's kingdom and the world system are locked into mortal combat. If you live for Jesus, you will inevitably draw fire from the people of this world. You know, it reminds me of the guy in heaven who was asked by the angel. He said, "Hey," he said, "did you do any kind deeds when you were down there on earth?" The fellow said, "Well, sure. Once a Hell's Angel jumped off his motorcycle and started picking on this little old lady. I grabbed him by the jacket. I kicked him in the shins. And then I told the old lady to run for help." The angel said, "Wow, how brave. When did this happen?" Fellow looked at him and said, "Oh, about 30 seconds ago." You know, there may come a time when you're attacked physically, but here Jesus is talking about more social persecution, hate and exclusion and reviling and slander. You will be mistreated by your coworkers. You'll be slighted. You'll be scorned. You'll be left out. You'll even be slandered if you live for Jesus. And when it happens, Jesus tells us how to react. He says, "Rejoice in that day and leap for joy. For indeed your reward is great in heaven. For in like manner their fathers did to the prophets." You will be treated unfairly for Jesus' sake. But when you do, when it happens, take heart. Leap for joy, Jesus says. Consider yourself blessed. Know that you're doing something right. Persecution on earth is proof that we're living a life pleasing to God. One proof. He says, "But woe to you who are rich, for you have received your consolation." This is the rich man who's satisfied with this world's riches. You know, he doesn't have time to lay up treasure in heaven. He's accumulating it all right now. This fellow's being extremely short-sighted. "Woe to you who are full, for you shall hunger. Woe to you who laugh now, for you shall mourn and weep." Boy, live for a stuffed stomach, or a stuffed bank account for that matter, and you'll lack eventually.
Being on the go is something we're all accustomed to in this culture. The hustle and bustle of life seems to make the days just fly by. For most of us, our smartphones are sort of an extension of our bodies. constantly ringing and dinging, telling us where to be and what the next appointment is. The technology that we enjoy in this day and age is amazing. And while there's certainly no end to the bad things we can find online and through our smartphones, there's also some great kingdom-minded options. We'd like to invite you to download the Sandy Adams mobile app. Our mobile app is available for iPhone, Android, and Windows smartphones. Or log on to sandyadams.org and simply click on the link from the main menu. When you download the app, you'll be able to listen to the most recent messages taught by Pastor Sandy, browse the series archive, and search the archive alphabetically. Finally, when you download the mobile app, you'll also have the opportunity to join us live for our Sunday morning worship service right from your smartphone. Again, to download the Sandy Adams mobile app, simply enter Sandy Adams in the search options of your smartphone's app store, or log on to sandyadams.org and simply click on the mobile app option right on the homepage. And please join us again as Pastor Sandy continues teaching through the Bible right here on Sandy Adams Radio.